There's nothing in the world, really, there, when you hear of 22,000 Christian workers out there, and the ripple effect from every one of those lives, the parameters of their influence, only God knows the impact of the 101 years of Moody Bible Institute. When you consider those who have been and are long since in glory, and their progeny, again, it will be heaven before we know or begin to understand. And that's one of the glories of heaven, I think, one of the great privileges, that then with unlimited knowledge we'll begin to comprehend the fallout, the impact, the influence of that which we only now can know in part. And to consider the fact that God could have used angels, rather he chose you and me, is a humbling thing indeed. None of us are worthy. Not one of us is worthy. And as this marvelous choir sang this afternoon, I thought, boy, this is going to beat when the director read from Revelation 4 and 5. This is going to beat Founders Week. It's going to be a tremendous time when all the millions of voices blend together singing praises to the Lamb. We have a great future. The headlines of the newspaper may not show it, but we have a great prospect, a great future. The best is indeed yet to come. And I would not trade places with Mr. Moody as much as I respect and admire him. I buried one of our oldest members. Matter of fact, our oldest member last August. I'm sure you heard about it. Reverend J.F. Aker. He was 115, born 1871. He had preached the gospel for 97 years. He knew Moody personally. And I asked him once, I said, what was Moody like? Well, son, said he was a lot like you. Noisy, simplistic. And Pastor Lutz overheard the conversation. He said, troublemaker. And there are a lot of adjectives one could add behind the name Moody. He affected two continents. God used him unlike anyone else in his century. And I cannot help but think that out from Moody Bible Institute, with all the great and grandiose plans that are being unveiled now, that there can be and have been and will yet be other Moody's. Not just men who can stand behind a pulpit and shake the world, but men and women who, in their particular place with their God-given gift and talent, do their thing. We have a much larger world. You know, the first time the world reached 1 billion population was 1860. And so Moody was here when the world first reached 1 billion in population. Now it's 5 billion, and we're told it will be 6.5 billion by the turn of the century, and only God knows before Jesus comes what the dilemma of this world will be politically and culturally and socially and, of course, spiritually. But I believe that God is always bigger than the need. And the challenge before us is not an unrealistic one. It's a very complex one. When I became pastor of Thomas Road Baptist Church in 1956 with 35 charter members, I was the pastor and the choir leader. Imagine that, Robbie. And the congregational song leader and the secretary and the janitor. And they paid me $65 a week, and several of the deacons thought I was overpaid. And in those days, a church with a pastor and a full-time secretary and a full-time custodian had a pretty good staff. And really, with a reasonably good mimeograph machine, you could operate and impact a small town. You didn't need counselors. We never heard of seminars. You did not need media personnel. You didn't need an AV expert. You didn't need Christian ed directors. You did not need teen workers, children's workers, senior saint workers, ministers to institutionalized persons. You did not need all the specialized ministers. At least we didn't think we did. And the fact is, we got along pretty well without being too bright. But that day is history. That day is history. And a Moody Bible Institute today that has stayed not only up with the times, but has been and continues to be the cutting edge, is an absolute necessity. It is an absolute necessity. I do not believe that God gave the media, radio, television, automation, computerization, the printing press, etc., etc., satellites. I don't believe God gave all of that for industry, for commerce, but I rather believe that with the population explosion of the past 100 years, it was God's intent that all of this be put in the hands of the church for the purpose of world evangelization, which has always been the ultimate goal of the gospel. God hasn't changed his mind. He said, go ye into all the world and preach the gospel to every creature, no matter how many creatures there are. 250 million persons on the earth when the Lord made that statement, gave that command. 20 times that many today. So obviously God adjusted all of the environment and gave to us the necessary instruments and means with which we can be obedient to his commission. Habakkuk chapter 2, verses 1 through 4. Habakkuk chapter 2, verses 1 through 4. That's the Old Testament, Robbie. I will stand upon my watch and set me upon the tower and will watch to see what he will say unto me and what I shall answer when I am reproved. And the Lord answered me and said, write the vision and make it plain upon tables, that he may run that readeth it. For the vision is yet for an appointed time. But at the end it shall speak and not lie. Though it tarry, wait for it, because it will surely come. It will not tarry. Behold, his soul which is lifted up is not upright in him, but the just shall live by his faith. Write the vision. Make it plain upon tables, that he may run that readeth it, for the vision is yet for an appointed time. I'm speaking on the appointed time. 1987. 13 years are ahead of us, and we enter the 21st century. Buck Rogers' tale seemed just a few years ago. And here we are now living in the midst of space travel. Our children will see and know things we only dream of, or perhaps are not capable of dreaming of. And yet, the only thing that impresses God is people. God is not impressed with buildings and budgets. A God who one morning before breakfast spoke the world into existence could hardly be impressed with the things that impress us. God is interested in only one thing, people. God so loved this world of people that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever among those people would believe on him, his death, his burial, his resurrection, should not perish, should not go to hell. Dr. E.V. Hill, pastor of Mount Zion Missionary Baptist Church in Watts, Los Angeles, preached for us in Lynchburg this morning. We'll preach again tonight and tomorrow morning to our students. He preached this morning on, you don't have to go to hell. And he pled with people, don't go to hell. But he said it's an option. You can go to hell if you wish. He preached that the other night, he said, and he called his wife, who, by the way, has just been wonderfully healed completely of cancer, in answer to prayer. He called his wife and chatted with her, and she said, honey, what did you preach on tonight? He said, you can go to hell. She said, Edward, are you drinking? He wasn't. The fact is, you can go to hell. And there are 5,000 million souls in this world who, if they do not receive Jesus Christ as personal Lord and Savior, will go to hell. Now, that impresses God. And I am not one of those, I'm a Calvinist, proper definition of the word. I believe in God's sovereignty. I also believe in human responsibility. I do not believe that anyone was foreordained to hell before birth. I believe that whosoever will may come, and that we do have the prerogative of making the decision. Writing my thesis in college, I remember writing on election. I knew a lot more about it then than now. And I took the point of predestination, 5 or 6 points maybe, and Calvinism, and I wrote all of that. But after 31 years at the same church, I've come to the awareness that while election is surely in the Bible, that the more people to whom you witness and share the gospel, the more get elected. And so the idea is just preach the gospel to every creature. That impresses God. That's God's program. That's God's plan. And for that reason, I want to share this vision with you. The vision is for today, for the appointed time. We are now in that, I think, last of the last days. When according to Joel 2, we may expect an outpouring of God's Spirit upon all flesh. And we shall dream dreams and see visions. I am not talking about the spurious expressions of the flesh that we see and hear so much of today. Noise, wildfire. But I am talking about spiritual awakening that will reap millions, if not scores of millions of souls into the kingdom, bring about revival, a revival of holiness that can in fact change national lifestyles. I still believe that God is bigger than any of the social and cultural problems that we're facing in our world today. I said when I started in the ministry, a pastor and a part-time secretary and maybe a part-time janitor would be an adequate staff. That isn't true anymore. Today we're facing some major crises, and if we do not face them forthrightly and courageously and with answers, if we do not write our visions plain so that others may read them and run with them, our children will curse our memory. These are crucial times. What are the major problems facing us today? I think as we look down the next few years, we must acknowledge that at the top of the list is that crisis of the possible loss of our liberties and freedoms. It is foolish to stick one's head in the sand and say that what has happened in Eastern Europe and Cuba and Nicaragua cannot happen here. It can happen here. In our pulpits, we pastors, in our Sunday school classes, we teachers, in our businesses and other enterprises, we entrepreneurs need to speak to the issues confronting the world today and clearly articulate right from wrong, freedom from slavery. Ye shall know the truth, know Christ, and the truth shall make you free. I am convinced that we pastors are to blame for a lot of the problems facing our society. For 120 or 25 years in this country, we thought that as born-again believers, all we needed to do was preach the gospel and get people saved. That is the primary thing. Jesus said, you're the light of the world. He also said, you're the salt of the earth. I think we have a responsibility to train our boys and girls up on the merits of freedom, democracy, respect for the civil rights of all, the importance of sensitivity to poverty, to needs all around us, and to the perils of godless Marxism. Sometimes we are afraid we'll be tagged as crusaders rather than preachers. But you know, Charles G. Finney wasn't afraid of that when he led the abolitionist movement early in the last century that broke the back of slavery in this country. And as we face the social issues, we should not be afraid in our pulpits to be enlightened. Ignorance is not bliss. And to tell our people the truth. I'm not talking about espousing political parties and politicians. They come and go with the wind. They're very unstable. Someone asked me in the press conference a moment ago, are you going to run for president? As a preacher of the gospel, I would consider that a step down. I really would. It would also be boring. So therefore, we in our pulpits and classes and in the circumference of our influence, wherever God puts us for the rest of our lives, we need to be courageous. God never called us to be popular. He only called us to be faithful. And I'm not talking about being obnoxious or getting on somebody's political bandwagon. I am talking about our responsibility to the next generation. Number two, teenage pregnancy and the abortion problem. You say, how does that fit in with a gospel ministry? Let me try to express it to you. I graduated from high school in 1950. Now, you'll compute that real quickly. I'm 53. I'll save you the time. I graduated from high school in 1950, a public high school. I was captain of my football team. I think I knew what was happening in the school. We in 4 years had one pregnant girl. That was before the pill, by the way, or Planned Parenthood. And the end result was, during those 4 years, we had few of the major complex problems that are facing kids today. We had no major drug problem, lots of other issues, but today, one teenage girl in four in America becomes pregnant. Why is that? Well, I'm not going to get into all of that. I think we all know that there are lots of places to put the blame. But I'm talking about the cure. What is the solution to this? I think the Church of Jesus Christ has the answer. And that is this. Number one, we as never before need to attack this problem. I know we're flying in the face of national television, network television. They've dumped their garbage soaps right into prime time with Dynasty, etc., etc. And our kids in the theater are seeing the kinds of promiscuity and permissiveness that are unbelievable. And I know that in the public schools there are major problems. But I would submit to you that we're having problems as well in our homes, in our churches, inside the Christian camp. A friend of mine, Josh McDowell, right now is crisscrossing the country with a series he's just put out that I think is magnificent, entitled Why Wait? Why Wait? Why not premarital sex? Why not sex before marriage? A majority of teenagers today are practicing that, whether you like it or are willing to realize it or not. Do we just curse the darkness? Of course we must preach against it. It is sin. All sex outside of marriage is sin, period. Say that on the Donahue Show. Say that on Nightline. Say that to your local news show. Say that in your church bulletin. Say that in the pulpit. But I'll tell you how we solve this problem. And our people need to be informed on it. Our young people, our boys and girls are not getting from the authority figures in their lives the right information. And the church is responsible. Not the educators, not the social engineers. The church is to blame. We're the salt of the earth. And for that reason, we need to take the biblical position on solving this problem. 1.5 million abortions every year in this country. 20 million little babies have died at the hands of the abortionists legally in this country since Roe v. Wade, January 1973. 14 short years. Are we going to solve it? The church can solve it on both sides. First of all, on the preventive side. Why did we not have child or teenage pregnancy as a major problem a generation ago, and we do have it today? The answer is, we were not better then. We were just better instructed. We were not better. That is a fact. We were just better instructed. At home, my father was an agnostic. I did not own a Bible. I became a Christian in college days as a result of hearing Charles E. Fuller on the radio. I was not a Christian. But my father and mother, and my father, when he voted, the vote was over. It was a majority. My father said, don't do it. It will complicate your life, and I'm not going to have it. Don't do it. That was it. We went off to school, and believe it or not, the first grade, the second grade, the third grade taught us values, and when we got up into adolescence and past puberty, in the high school, they told us, don't do it. And nobody thought it was judgmental. They thought maybe they love us. Maybe they care about us. And so, in the mouth of two witnesses, it was being established. And then my mother, who did go to church, would often take us with her, and we would hear the pastor and the Sunday school teacher say, don't do it. And in unison, in the three authority figures that really impacted our lives, we heard total, absolute agreement. Today, the various social engineers and the unions that represent our teachers and add to it all the other societies, they all say in unison, that's judgmental, that's religious instruction, to which I say baloney. You've had 30 years to pack your doctrine out here, and you've done nothing but ruin our children. Education can solve it. I was debating this issue with a member of the LA school board on national television, and she was advocating the sex clinics. And there are now 71 of them in the public schools, what we used to call junior high schools, middle schools now, and high schools. 71 of them, test projects, sex clinics, where they dispense birth control pills and contraceptives to 13, 14-year-old young people. I said, that's like passing out cookbooks at a fat farm. You'd have to have a PhD to be that dumb. You absolutely couldn't think of that. You couldn't think of that if you hadn't sat under somebody long enough. What is your solution, Reverend? I said, well, I think back, we need to come back to the homes from infancy saying, don't do it. We need to get all the school teachers to be saying, don't do it. You don't have to believe what we believe religiously. Look at the problems. Look at the unborn babies. Look at the abortions. Look at the social diseases. Isn't there enough medical and social evidence to say your experiments have failed? Let's get back in the churches. We pastors. Let's teach our people. Thank God for the James Dobsons and the John MacArthurs and the Chuck Swindolls. And thank God for all these good people who have a special ministry in those areas. But every church ought to be a family training center. And we can do it. But we can't be afraid of whose feelings we're going to hurt. You know, we've been tiptoeing through the tulips for 100 years. It's time for us to come out of the closets and begin preaching the Bible again, what the Bible has to say about it. On the curative side, I think the church has an obligation, if it's going to condemn abortion, to provide an alternative. Put your money where your mouth is. I for years, have marched every year on the anniversary of Roe v. Wade with thousands of others, cold, hot, whatever, usually cold, in Washington. I'm working for legislative reform. Mr. Mondale said I was appointing the Supreme Court. If I could, I would. And we want to see, we have one vote away from a pro-life court, just one. We were 7-2 against us. It's now 5-4 against us. One more appointment. I know they'll go in there in cots to wait the president out, but, you know, the Lord may have something to do with that. And I would hope one day we'll have a pro-life court. But in the meantime, what are we doing on the positive side? What are the alternatives? If a law were passed today to stop abortions in America, like prohibition, a generation ago, my prediction is, like in prohibition, the underworld abortion industry, back alley, kitchen table, coat hanger abortions, it would be such an awful situation that repeal would be guaranteed and we'd never change the law again. It is not for us, not enough for us just to curse the darkness. We must build an infrastructure in this country of enough homes, ministries of love, with 1.5 million beds in them, the number of women now having abortions in this country, free to the girl, free to the taxpayer, whatever you wish to call them, with the 500 we've started, 500 homes we call Liberty Godparent Homes, but Mercy Homes, reaching out to black, white, red, yellow, rich, poor, anyone who knocks on the door at any age, in our little home in Lynchburg, Virginia, through our telephone hotline counseling and personal counseling and the residence that is provided and then the child placement agency that God has given us. In 5 years, we've been able to work in one center with 30,000 girls who did not have abortions. And God's helped us to start over 500 more homes, and our goal is to start 10,000 such homes owned and operated by local churches, where doctors and nurses and school teachers and counselors and all the rest who love Christ in a labor of love join together. There are a few paid staff, but it should be primarily a labor of love, so it is no burden upon any church budget, small or large, so that no... And if we do that, if we get enough homes and enough beds, it won't be very long before God may smile on us, and one day a Supreme Court, a newly constructed Supreme Court, will say, in their considerations of Roe v. Wade for modification or reversal, say to us, what is to prevent the creation of such an underworld industry if we in fact do modify or reverse Roe v. Wade? And we need to be able to say, Your Honors, the Church of Jesus Christ has constructed, has built an alternative system. We have enough beds, enough homes, enough doctors, enough nurses, enough professional persons. We have the places. We have 100 Christian homes waiting for every baby that is available for adoption, and that's a fact. We have everything at no cost to the girl or the taxpayer. I think at that point in time, we'll have earned the right to break the back of abortion, and the teenage pregnancy situation through teaching and proper example can be corrected. This country is not hopelessly down the drain. Young people are not animals who cannot be taught. We don't have to take the fatalistic approach that they're going to do it anyway, so let's give them contraceptives and birth control pills and get involved in damage control. Rather, let's take a positive point of view that the Judeo-Christian ethic, the biblical ethic on which the nation was built, still works, and go back to it. It can be done, it needs to be done, and the church must lead the way. Education. We're all alarmed at the secularizing of education. Dr. Francis Schaeffer, the late Dr. Francis Schaeffer, came out with one of your speakers next year, Dr. Cook, Whatever Happened to the Human Race, pointing out that two major issues were facing this country. Two major issues. This is 10 years ago. The secularizing of our republic and the devaluing of human life. Under that, abortion, infanticide, euthanasia were highlighted. What is this secularizing of America? It's the purging from our textbooks, our classrooms, our society, any mention of God, any awareness of our religious heritage, any belief that this is a nation under God. It is exactly what has happened, of course, in Russia and Red China and the Marxist world. It is happening. And our boys and girls are being fed a dose of it 6 hours a day, 5 days a week. Now, it's one thing to cry out against secular humanism, and I don't think anybody has a bigger mouth on that subject than I do. But we have no right to address the issue unless we're providing an alternative. There are two alternatives. One, Christian schools. There are 34,000 Christian schools in this country now. 1961, as we were approaching that court ruling, Madeline O'Hare and Shemp that removed prayer and Bible reading from the schools, there were 1,400 such Christian schools in 1961. There are now 34,000. Three or four new ones are starting daily. What does that mean? That means that there are many Christian parents out there, and most of them through local churches, that are providing an alternative. Distinctively, unabashedly, Christian schools are now being formed. I'm glad for that. Our three children all came through Lynchburg Christian Academy. Kindergarten 4, right through high school. I may have started them for my children. I don't recall exactly. Some say I did. Jerry Jr. gets his law degree this year at the University of Virginia. He's 24. Jeannie is in medical school, age 22, working towards becoming a surgeon at the Medical College of Virginia in Richmond. Jonathan, our 20-year-old redhead, gets his BA degree this year at Liberty University and is going off to Dallas Seminary next year to be a preacher. Lawyer, doctor, preacher. My 53-year-old wife graduates from Liberty University this year in May. And all of my family, all of our children have come through Christian schools all the way. They've never, until they got to a professional school, they had never been under an unregenerate school teacher. Now, for us, that was best. But it's unrealistic to say that is God's will for everybody. In the first place, if everybody dumped their kids into the Christian schools today, we couldn't handle them nor build them fast enough. And if everybody dumped them into our schools today, we couldn't control them. There are a lot of reasons why the exclusion of public schools is not an alternative. So at Liberty University, like right here and in other Christian schools, we're training school teachers who love God, who believe the Bible, who are being given a quality education, who are being certified in all the states, and who in fact will be teaching in public schools, and hundreds of them right now in public schools. We have 1,000 school teachers in training. We had to fight the ACLU for the right to believe creationism and graduate certified school teachers. We took 3 years fighting that one. We won it. It's worth it. You know, anything worth doing is worth the price, and you can usually do what you ought to do. And therefore, for that reason, we need to improve the public schools. We happen to have a Secretary of Education today, William Bennett, a Harvard graduate, a Roman Catholic, who is committed to all the views and values you and I believe in, and under the present president is doing a tremendous amount towards improving public education. We ought to pray and work for that. We ought to encourage our people from the pulpit to get elected to the school board, to get involved in the PTA, get involved in the schools. We are not isolationists. God deliver us from this monk syndrome of hiding away in a cave, letting the world go to hell while we have our little sweet pure thing going over to the corner somewhere. We're supposed to impact society. Yes, we want Christian schools for those who believe that's what I want for my family. Yes, we must have better public schools, and the church can make the difference. We have spent all of our time with 30-odd sexes shooting at everything we don't like and blasting out the lights and cussing everything that moves, that we've lost our credibility. We need to be debating those issues, but at the same time infiltrating the system. Journalism. National media is lousy. Period. You know, that's just the way it is. And you're not going to help Sam Donaldson much. Dan Rather isn't going to change his philosophy much. And the idea is what? Do we shut down journalism? Do we censor? Do we close? You can't do that. This is a free society. But we have an alternative. The Church of Jesus Christ, through its Christian schools, can produce quality journalists who can do from the right what they've done to us from the left, infiltrate. Go in, get a job in a little station, do it better, get out there. We can also, through our churches, buy cable networks. We can develop. We're doing some of that ourselves, some we can't talk about yet, but get out there and get our own voice. And don't let it be wall-to-wall preaching. Thank God for this Moody Network. And I think on a national scale, television, biblically based, conservative politically, free enterprise, highlighted, an alternative voice on all the issues. You could have, you know, you really could have a Phil Donahue show with somebody who knows north from south moderating it. You really could. You could have. You could really have all of that if we will just become creative and decide we're the salt of the earth. We are part of this thing too. Our citizenship is in heaven, but while we are passing through, we ought to change the fabric of the society. And that's what it means. We're the salt of the earth. We are preserver. We put savor and taste into society. And I submit to you that the Church of Jesus Christ can cure that problem. What about the drug epidemic? Oh, what a crisis facing our kids today. In your city, in my city, very little difference. Drugs are everywhere. Are you going to stop the drug czars, the drug pushers? It's awfully hard. I am for stronger enforcement of laws, firmer enforcement of laws that exist, and new laws. I'm in favor of getting tough and all of that. But you know that won't stop it. You can't stop sin with just laws. You've got to get to hearts. We will work legislatively and judicially. In that area, it's important. But we, the Church of Jesus Christ, must also get into the issue. Tom Harris is going to be here next year. You've got to hear that young man. He was a drug user, a drug pusher. He was living, shacking up with, as we say it in Virginia, with a girl. Had some children when he met Jack Wurtson at Word of Life. He and Vicky both got saved. Then they got married. You know, that always happens. When people really get saved, they stop living immorally. Got saved, got married, went to Bible college. You know what Tom did? He's a Greek. He came back to where his drug scene had been lived out and started a church in the bottom of a waterworks of New York City, Manhattan, up at 205th, where you can park your car and walk away with it from it 5 minutes and come back and find nothing. And nobody stole the car. They took it piece by piece. Started a church in the basement of a waterworks. He's running 1,300 in attendance every Sunday now. He has built a tremendous work. Bing Crosby's wife goes to church there. And the worst drug pimps in the world have gotten saved. Drug users in the world and pimps and prostitutes have gotten saved there. And when you say, is it a black church? Is it a white church? Is it an oriental church? No way to tell. Those are street people. They're a little mixture of everything. But people whom God loved and Christ died for. And it's a marvelous place to preach. I took Morley Safer there with me once in 60 Minutes. He was trailing around. And he flew up from Lynchburg. And I didn't tell him what he was going to walk into. And we walked in the basement of that great big church. And Tom began putting up converts, giving their testimonies. Unless you have been in that part of our world, and it's part of it right here in Chicago, you really don't know how the other half is living. And they told where they were when God saved them. And one cameraman from CBS, About six testimonies in, tears were flowing. One cameraman behind the camera just pulled away from behind the camera and said, "Hallelujah, CBS, hallelujah." The church can make a difference. Let me tell you what he's doing now in the drug problem. You saw, I think, the network show, CBS did it, Dan Rather, on crack. I think it was Crack Street was the name of it. And it was done right up there in his neighborhood. He has, among other great ministries there, he has purchased a building and put a detox center there, a detoxification center. They lead these drug addicts to Christ. It is a complex problem. They must first be detoxified. They've got to be helped medically through a very crucial time in their lives. They may die. They bring them through that in the name and the power of Christ. Second stop, they bought a farm upstate New York outside the city for a rehab, a rehabilitation center. And they then move them to the rehab place and they stay there all under Christian ministry. Some of our Liberty graduates are working there. One of them heads it up, working with them. And after a few weeks or months, they come back into the real world, ready again to live, totally set free and liberated from crack, from cocaine, from heroin, from whatever. The power of the gospel of Christ is still greater than any force on this earth. And we in our churches, while we can condemn drugs, and we must do that, and add liquor along with it. It's a liquid drug just as vicious, if not more so, than the rest. It is not enough to say, as the politicians are in Washington and the networks are, say no to crack. Say no to John Barleycorn too. Say no to Miller Lowlife too. Say no to all of the booze that is a part of the drug scene. I usually don't get invited but once in the house, so I'm just... But drugs. The Church of Jesus Christ can solve the drug issue. We can provide a better way, and they're all needing help. Tom Harris, George, was giving this out the other night at a public place, and in the audience was Mayor Ed Koch and Governor Mario Cuomo. They were so taken with it that they came to Tom afterwards and said, "For God's sake, will you let us get into this with you and help you do it?" I said, "Be careful, Tom. They could mess it up. Be careful." And Tom's very wise, but what I'm trying to say to you is the public officials don't have a solution. They do not have a solution. That's not a put-down. It's a matter of fact. The secular world has no solution to the major spiritual and social and drug problems facing our society. Only the church does. And we cannot just say we're against this and against that. We've got to provide another way. What about poverty? We can turn our heads if we wish and say it doesn't exist. But I find myself living in Lynchburg, but in major cities almost every day. And at nighttime, driving to the hotel, I see them sleeping on the street corner. I see them everywhere. You say, "Well, they got it coming. They wouldn't work in a pie shop eating the holes out of donuts." You can take the attitude that they're not worthy of help. But I remind you, they are the only thing that impresses God. Pacific Garden Mission never took that attitude. They never did. They've always had their doors open and their arms out. And I believe that pleases the Lord. And we in our churches have got to do just what Pacific Garden Mission has been doing now for over 100 years. I think 109 to be exact. I was there a few months ago for that celebration. Robbie was too. We've got to open family centers. E.V. Hill, I mentioned, preaching for us all day today. Oh, what a preacher he is. You've been out there, Dr. Sweeting, I believe. Mount Zion Missionary Baptist Church. Right in the middle of Watts, back when the town was burning, he was God's man holding up the banner, and God used him through the gospel to bring that thing to peace. I was out there preaching for him the other night, packed. I was the only pale face in that whole big crowd. Sitting on the platform between Dr. Hill, I weigh 250, and I can stand behind him. And Dr. Hill was on one side and his associate the other, and just before I was getting up to preach after 2 hours of soul music, he said, "Do you feel like an Oreo?" I pretended I didn't hear a word. I walked up to the pulpit like a dignified man of God and then broke out laughing on television. Let me tell you something. It's not enough for us to talk about free enterprise. We do believe in it. We believe in work, the work ethic. But the Church of Jesus Christ has got to come out of its coziness and its ivory tower and get down by the soup lines and the rescue missions and the family centers and put clothing on the backs of the naked and food in the mouths of the hungry and whatever it takes to do it. We're just one little town, Lynchburg. We only have a 60,000 population and everybody's home. And we have a family center downtown, and our little family center, clothing, shoes, and by the way, all the professionals in our church sign up, plumbers, electricians, doctors, dentists, roofers, bricklayers, whatever, and they agree to tithe their time. So as applications come, not just from our members, anybody, if you're hungry, hole in your roof, your house needs patching, you need oil in your furnace, need a dentist to do your children's work, clothes to go to school, whatever. When they apply, our pastors, we have 102 pastors who go out and meet with them and try to begin using that entree to impart Christ, of course. But that isn't a requirement for help. And then we assign to these professions in the church, these people, go out, do this, do that, do this, do this. And the end result has been that if there is anybody in our area who is hungry, it's because they haven't come. We have never had a problem getting enough food and enough clothing and enough professional people to help. Never. We've just had a problem organizing it properly so we get it all done. Because people are ready. Our people, pastors, listen. Those of you who are leading in Christian ministry, our people are ready. All they want from us is leadership. Provide, create the program. Tap us in. Show us what to do. School teachers, these Liberty Godparent homes I told you about. You know, a little girl never misses a day from school. And oh, they come there with heartbroken. We had three 12-year-old girls in the last 2 years. Pregnant by their fathers. You know, most of us in our little churches don't know what's happening out there. And we had to find six homes, adoptive homes, because we had six children involved there. And working with them. And our school teachers come over the afternoons and teach them. So when they go back to school, whoever they are, they haven't missed a day. They're right up with it. They don't have to have any money. All of these needs I'm addressing here. I'm trying to write the vision plain. Sure, we keep on winning souls. That's the primary thing. Preach the gospel. But along with it, we must identify the needs, the problems. I could talk about moral permissiveness. We could talk about so many things. We have made moral permissiveness a way of life in America. We have made homosexuality an acceptable lifestyle. And we have, in our condemning of homosexuality, have not enough so reached out in love to the homosexual. Have not. And the end result of that is we embitter and drive them from the gospel rather than attract them to. We've got to be able to do as our Lord did, to discern and make it so clear that while we hate sin, we love the sinner. If the little girl is pregnant, or the poor old drunk is inebriated, or the homosexual boy has gotten into a perverted lifestyle, or the man is on a needle now, we cannot look with contempt upon sinners. Jesus looked with love upon them. And it's not enough to say that we are against what you're doing when they ask us, what have you got as an alternative? We can say, come this way. We have a pastor for that. We have a ministry for that. We have this for that. Churches, what I'm trying to say to you is this. No matter where the problem is in our society, Jesus Christ is the answer. I mentioned E.V. Hill. You need to go out there sometime just to let him or one of his staff members take you on the tour. They are doing the greatest work with the poor in the world today. You go out there and watch. Can you imagine a black pastor in Watts who's a conservative politically? You'd think they'd shoot that guy on sight. They all love him. You know why? He's earned the right to believe anything he wants to. Because they know he loves me. I may not agree with his politics, but I sure agree with what Christ has done in his life and what he's doing for me. As a result of that, he is a respected man. If you walk with him down the street, nobody will ever mug you, because they wouldn't touch anybody who's a friend of E.V. Hill. That's how they feel about him. And that is exactly what we're saying here tonight, today. You and I are facing the 21st century. The need is overwhelming. If you listen to enough of the 6 o'clock news and read enough of the AP wire stories, You'll throw up your hands and retreat from the real world. That's not what we need. We're to be on the offensive. Jesus said upon this rock, speaking of himself, I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. We are kicking down the gates of hell into the drug world, into the moral permissiveness world, into the secular humanistic world, into every sector of society. If we hope to hear him one day say, well done, we've got to do it. Don't just curse the darkness. Light a few candles. Determine how can I, as a pastor, as a Sunday school teacher, as a deacon, as a Christian father or mother, how can I make a difference? Seek the Lord's face, find his purpose and will, and then get in there and dig a foxhole and go to work. Could we stand to pray? Our Father and our God, in the name of your Son, our Savior, Jesus Christ, raise up some Moody's in this audience with their little Sunday schools and godparent homes and detox and rehab centers and rescue missions and street preaching and jail visits and expressions of love in so many ways. Become a part of the solution. Raise up some young people to go into journalism and medicine with a biblical code of ethics, into education, to classrooms, to regather our young people. God, raise up the personnel who love you to solve the problem. Oh, God, give us the vision and help us then to write it and make it plain upon tables so that we all who read it may run with it to our place of ministry. God, in this, the appointed time, for Jesus' sake,